Stars and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. This is episode 64, The Clock. The Clock is a 1945 film from MGM, directed by Vincente Minnelli, with Judy Garland and Robert Walker. Judy Garland in her very first dramatic role. And I have three wonderful panelists to talk about The Clock with me, beginning with Randy Dattinga. Hi, Randy.
Well, I'm just here for the unexpected Angela Lansbury's mother.
Good spotting there. Good spotting. There's a lot of things and people to spot in this movie. Nathan Alderman, hi.
Hi. Does anyone know where I can find a shoe repair place?
Open at this hour?
They bang really hard on the door and somebody will be there to welcome you. Mickey Maynard is also here. Hello.
Well, I'm looking for the Astor and somebody told me they tore it down.
1967 was not so long ago. I looked that up. Well, friends, thanks so much for joining me. We're going to talk about The Clock, which, as I said, is Judy Garland's first dramatic role. She wouldn't do another one. And I forgot about this because I'm such a fan of A Star Is Born, which was both a dramatic role and a musical role. But she wouldn't do another straight dramatic role until 1961 when she did Judgment in Nuremberg. And this was one she wanted to do because she wanted to do something other than musicals. And I thought, oh, well, she just wants to stretch her dramatic wings. But also musicals, I don't know if you know this, very tiring. A lot of work involved in musicals. But I want to ask my usual first question, which is how each of you guys found this movie, whether you had seen it before. Randy, is this the first time you saw this movie?
Yeah, this is the first time. I kept looking for Ray Milland, but he's in The Big Clock from 1948. So remember, the clock, different clocks, that one's bigger. Yeah, this is my first time seeing this movie, and I thought it was charming. I'm a little mystified that in The New Yorker, their critic Richard Brody, he wrote an article in June of this year in honor of Judy Garland's 100th birthday, saying that this is Judy Garland's greatest film, and he rhapsodizes about it and about its eroticism, which I don't know if he saw the same movie.
But I
enjoyed the movie. I don't think it was a great movie, but a good movie, and I really was intrigued by the portrayal of New York City, which I watch a lot of noir, and usually New York is actively hostile to characters in movies that I watch, or at the very least indifferent. And here, New York is this kind of charming character. This couple finds joy in subway mobs, and they find their way through all these obstacles that seem kind of red tape, and even the people like putting up the obstacles just give way pretty easily. So it's a whole different kind of New York than kind of modern and then some of the classic depictions of the city.
And yet there are obstacles. And I want to talk about the portrayal of New York and how they did it, which I thought was super interesting because I hadn't read about it until after I watched the movie. So interesting stuff there. Mickey, do you have a background with this movie? Seen it before?
Yeah. In my youth in Detroit, this was shown on Bill Kennedy. And the interesting thing about this movie is it's only 90 minutes and Bill Kennedy's show was 2 hours. And that meant scenes got cut from a number of movies, but he was able to show all of The Clock from start to finish and then have a little time to talk about The Clock. So way, way back, I mean, I'm sure it was junior high or somewhere then. And I thought it was a charming, sweet movie. And of course, I'm a lover of New York and the movies. And I always love to see how they are able to replicate and kind of meld in scenes of New York without actually shooting in New York. And this is a good example.
It's interesting because this movie, it's 90 minutes, which is about right for this kind of movie in this era and this sort of level of budget. But there are moments at which it's a little slow. It could have. There are things you, if you were good at cutting, which most people who do TV versions of movies are not. If you were good at cutting, you probably could have found a way to pull a couple minutes out of it.
But, yeah, but I think the languid pace. The whole blood test thing you could have lost.
Yeah, that's a little long. That's
you could have lost one floor.
Hot blood testing action.
So Nathan, how about you? Is this another one I dragged you into for the first time?
It is. I had read that New Yorker article about it, waxing rhapsodic about it. And like Randy, I feel like the movie kind of flopped to a halt about maybe three quarters of the way toward that article's assessment. But this is actually, as far as I know, this is my first Vincente Minnelli film. Aside from bits and pieces of The Wizard of Oz, this may actually be my first Judy Garland film.
Really?
Yeah.
Ever?
That's interesting.
Ever. You know, I mean, I know who Judy Garland is. I've heard all the movie biographies and everything. But yeah. There's so much that I really like about this film, including the incredible technical craftsmanship of Vincente Minnelli, which is, I mean, this is an exquisitely made film. But I love the sense of New York as a character, like Mickey and Randy both mentioned. I love the supporting cast. I just wish they had bothered to write a center to this movie. It's like a donut. There's delicious, wonderful stuff all around the outside and nothing at the center.
There's something that I noticed watching it. I mean, first of all, this is one of those movies that if one of the characters had a cell phone, we wouldn't really have a movie.
right.
Right. But also, there is conflict with the girl, the roommate, who basically says, you know, how dare you let a soldier pick you up, blah, 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 and you've got a date with Freddie. And it feels like there could have been a scene where Freddie actually comes over and she dumps him versus just deciding, I'm going to go meet the soldier. There's like a little chunk that could have added even more, you know, I've got to make a decision. Do I go with the safe guy that I've been dating since I got to New York or whatever, and this soldier that just dropped into my life in the train station? And I felt like that could have been tightened up a little bit more.
Well, and even as emotional as the scene with the roommate was, they could have had her back in once more, even if we never meet Freddie, which I was kind of fine with. But she's like, no, this is a terrible idea. Don't do this. And the implication is that at some point later on, Judy Garland is going to have to come back home and go, hey, guess what? I'm getting married. Would you stand up for me? Or something like that.
Yeah.
Hashtag justice for Bill.
Just Bill, who has one line. And so I wonder, what did Bill get paid? Is he a contract player? He's wearing that ugly tie. He's sitting there in that whole scene. And all Bill gets to say in the whole movie is, bye.
Bill is great. I love Bill. That whole, I love that whole scene. I feel bad because Robert Walker had a rough life. He had a rough life before he discovered acting. Then he met and fell in love with Jennifer Jones, and they had kids, and they like built a life together. And then Howard Hughes stole Jennifer Jones out when, well, he stole Jennifer Jones, and Jennifer Jones decided to be stolen. And Robert Walker essentially spent the rest of his life slowly dying of a broken heart until he finally tipped over the edge. And so I really feel bad saying this, but the movie's problems begin and end, partly with the script and partly with Robert Walker, who is grotesquely and creepily miscast.
There were some moments with Robert Walker where you could see that there was, you know, the wishiness of golly, golly, I'm here. And can I walk with you to Fifth Avenue and all that? And then there are these moments where he's got some real strength, some real Joel McRae looking strength to him. And I would have liked to have seen him come out of the cocoon of the wishy soldier and become this really strong, decisive person. But their 90 minutes, I guess, doesn't give you enough time to do that.
They could have written him like that and just a strong, decisive person who is nonetheless out of place. But instead he's, well, golly, look at all them tall buildings. And he's got that like creepy high-pitched voice. He's clearly playing younger than he actually is. And his receding hairline is like, nope, in every scene. I mean, it's like I am increasingly haggard because, you know, 2022, I'm in well into my 40s now. And it's like casting me to play like a 19-year-old. No, it's not going to work. And it doesn't. And he's just, it's not that he's a bad actor. It's that he is wrong for this part and he plays it all wrong.
He doesn't seem like someone that she would fall in love with. I mean, he doesn't present that kind of like lovability, that charm, and that someone like her would just fall for just in a few hours. I mean, he's
well, and also she's been in New York for 3 years. From I'm not sure, did she come from Minnesota? What was her home base? Or do we
I'm not sure if that's clear. I think he's from Minnesota, but it's not
Louisiana, I think.
Or... Single woman, 3 years in New York. She has realistically knifed at least five people by this point in self-defense.
Right. So she's figured out the city. She works in an office. She takes the subway. You know, he tries to get a cab in the middle of the night. She's like, oh, that's too expensive. And I'm like, lady, let him get you a cab.
Right. He's got some dough.
She's got street sense. Absolutely. And he doesn't. And, you know, it worked for Frank Sinatra in On the Town because he was Frank Sinatra, you know, running around with the guidebook from 1907 or whatever. And then he finally meets his match. But this is definitely not a good connection, and I don't really see why she would have so quickly flipped for him. We need that moment, you know, that they're really, oh my gosh, this is the man for me moment. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be there.
I have theories. Mm-hmm. So this for Robert Walker is the moment at which, and it's David O. Selznick, not Howard Hughes, but it's David O. Selznick who steals Robert Walker's wife pretty much.
Yes. Well, Howard Hughes stole everyone else's wife.
Exactly.
My apologies for the confusion.
I'm sure Howard Hughes will sue you in absentia. But so David O. Selznick basically sweeps Jennifer Jones off her feet and she allows herself to be swept. Up until this point, Robert Walker, too, he wasn't in musicals the way Judy Garland was, but he had been playing the golly gosh, literally soldier who, whenever you had a ensemble cast movie of people in World War II, he was the young, fresh-faced one who probably would get killed second.
What?
And yeah,
what?
He absolutely was this sort of innocent guy. And it's funny because having had that background and having seen this movie, I sort of allowed that to, in the past, I allowed that to sort of color my perception of it. And I hadn't seen this movie in quite some time. And then when I saw it last night, I was just like, oh, Robert Walker is wrong for this because he's not the character that I think they might have cast. So Robert Walker, apparently Judy Garland, who was in no great shakes herself, was scraping Robert Walker up out of bars during the shooting of this movie because he was in terrible shape because his wife had just left him. And so this is sort of the beginning of the spiral downward for Robert Walker. And how directly you can connect that to his acting, I don't know. But in previous parts he had, it really was about, you know, I'm the sort of sacrificial, fresh-faced young boy in the platoon, basically. And then, of course, later on, he goes on to play. And I do think if you've seen something like Strangers on a Train or some of the movies he made toward the end of his life, you're just like, it's easier to sort of read him as creepy in this movie. But or if not creepy, I mean, I don't read him as creepy, but I read him as much more sort of sullen and different than the character he is intended to be playing.
Okay, wait. So Judy Garland is upset with him and is about to leave a dinner date that they have made. And and he stares at her, he goes, "You have brown eyes." No, look, I am that guy, like I am that in love with my amazing wife, but I don't say it in a serial killer tone of voice.
What I noticed this time was at the beginning, like when he's basically sort of following her around and basically saying, hey, well, first of all, the couple of guys he's trying to get information from about New York City, and then her, and then he's basically like, we are going to go to the shoe repair store and we are going to get that guy to open up. There are a couple of points early in the movie where he's like weirdly aggressive and then he pulls back. Mm-hmm. And I keep expecting to see more of that later in the movie. It's like, oh, is that what people are talking about? Is that why Robert Walker seems wrong for this part? But I think both his performance and the way that he was written is sort of weird. I think we're supposed to find the two of them sweet together and them to be believable because they're such lovable characters in previous movies that they've made. And I think whether it was Robert Walker's personal life or just getting older, something went wrong.
Well, there's a parallel between this movie and A Place in the Sun because you have Elizabeth Taylor, who is on her way up, gorgeous, 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 who is rescuing Montgomery Clift in that movie. And we don't really get a sense of why she would have loved Montgomery Clift, except that she feels kind of sorry for him. He is not a strong, I mean, he's not a particularly strong character, although he throws Shelley Winters into the lake. But there's this whole woman rescuing guy who needs rescuing trope in movies. And this predated that by 8 or 9 years, essentially.
And it's weirdly condescending to Judy Garland's character, too, because, like, she's got it together. She's got a pretty good life. And it's like, nope, you're so lonely and pathetic that you'll just fall for this total rando soldier from Hicksville, USA, who's, you know, off to a meat grinder in 2 days. This is all you deserve, Judy Garland. Enjoy it.
So I do like the mention of On the Town, because obviously that's another New York movie where soldiers or sailors in that case are coming into town and they've got a day to make the most of it. I watched The Best of Everything last night, which is a movie that we're going to see for Lions, Towers and Shields sometime soon. And the reason I mention it is because it's another story of, well, it's more of a story of New York office life and women in New York office life and the sort of terrible, creepy men they have to put up with. And it happens 15 years after this movie. But for some reason, I'm thinking about Judy Garland as the office, the secretary, who's sort of in that situation where she's an urban girl. She's got men in her life. She's got a roommate. She's probably not making a lot of money, but she's doing okay. And she's more sophisticated than Robert Walker, who shows up, which is kind of the reverse of Best of Everything, where every single man in that movie is predatory. So yeah, I feel like I'm in this New York continuum between The Clock and On the Town and The Best of Everything. And I don't know, you could throw in Mad Men. You could throw in all sorts of New York movies where women don't necessarily get the best in terms of the men in their lives.
So the interesting thing about this movie is it came out in May of 1945, even though it had been filmed earlier. I think it was filmed in late 1944. So by May of 1945, we've had VE Day. The war is still going on over in Japan and the Pacific, but the war is pretty much done. And you can almost watch this and go, why don't you just wait? Give it another couple months. The guys will be coming back from Europe. You don't have to settle for this guy who's going to England at the end of the war. I mean, just wait for the flyboys to come back and the guys that fought off the Nazis with one hand, and you'll have better pickings.
That's so mercenary.
But I'm just thinking of it like you're sitting in a theater in Times Square in 1945 watching this versus like 1943 watching this. And in 1943, you would definitely want to show sympathy and support for the poor guys who are being sent over to God knows what. But by the time you're sitting in the movie theater in 45, they're going to be home in the next few months.
It really does feel like a 43 movie. I think you're totally right about that. And I saw 45 as the release, but I didn't look at what month. And I think that's absolutely true, because by then, even if you're not being mercenary about it, and obviously in the extras of the movie, there are a lot of background characters, most of whom are sailors, which is interesting. The military guys that you see are almost always sailors, but there clearly is a lot of churn of people in and outside of New York. And you know, I think we've established, you know, throughout, Judy Garland is not looking for this relationship. And in fact, he kind of won't let her go. She almost doesn't have a choice, because at every point she's like, OK, got to go. And he follows her and she lets him follow her. But it does feel much more like a 43 movie, and especially in terms of the pacing, because, you know, it's a very, even though it occurs over the course of like a day and a half or 2 days, it's a very slow moving kind of thing. And the relationship, I guess, moves fast, but the individual scenes themselves are quite long and sort of luxurious. And it just, like I say, it feels more 1943. It feels like we're in the middle of a long war, and it totally makes sense that this relationship, where she literally doesn't go home. After she goes home to change for her date, she doesn't go home for the rest of the movie. So she never gets to have that confrontation with her roommate, who would be like, wait, you just did what?
Do you feel like there's a war on? I mean, it's, everybody seems to be in good spirits. Like you see a view of a Penn Station at the beginning, and it just seems like a normal, joyful day. There's no darkness, except maybe a little bit toward the end when they talk about, you know, Joe might go to England and die, but then they kind of put that away and don't really deal with it very much. Do you guys feel like it shows that they're in wartime?
And there's lots of milk when you think about it.
A lot of milk. No milk ration.
What about rationing? They go to the restaurant. There's people are dining out.
Angela Lansbury's mom has a gigantic plate of food.
Yeah, where did they get bacon? I mean, why bacon and muffins and whatever? I mean, there was rationing going on. So
I think that part's more questionable than the sort of churn of people in Penn Station. I mean, that part to me makes sense, yeah, because the people who aren't at war are going to continue to have their jobs. And then you're going to have a churn of military people coming into and out of the city, both for military leave reasons and also probably going to where they're going to be shipped out from the Brooklyn Navy Yard, or they're going to be, you know, New York is a transit point.
Aberdeen. I thought that was very interesting. And so then he's kind of slips that he's going to England. So he's probably Army Air Corps, because there's a air base or there was at Aberdeen. Mm. And then my dad was in the Army Air Corps and went to England and then the Mediterranean after that. So he's headed to England. When it was filmed, he could have been headed to England for Normandy, for the invasion. That's never talked about because it's happened already and the war's over.
That would have been a year ago.
So it feels, like you said, it does feel like a 43 pre-Normandy kind of a screenplay. And for whatever reason, it just didn't get made and it didn't come out. Well, it didn't get made probably because of Meet Me in St. Louis being such a huge hit. And she wanted to choose her next movie carefully, or they wanted her to do another musical and she wanted to do this.
Also, Joe has terrible OPSEC. I mean, loose link sink ship. And Joe is out there going, yeah, I'm going to this base at this time and I'll be headed to there. And hey, you see those ships floating in the river? They're a naval convoy. Somewhere in Nazi Salvatore is like, Joe, yes, keep talking to Joe de Garland. This is very good.
So this movie, and I had forgotten this, I actually like to watch these and then do the research afterwards. It's much more fun for me. This movie was shot entirely on the back lot. And there are plenty of scenes in it where you can tell that that's the case. Mm-hmm. But there are plenty of street scenes early on that look really well done. And even if you were looking for it and you were able to spot things that were matte paintings or backdrops or whatever, it's nicely done. Apparently the Penn Station set was quite expensive, and that's the thing that Minnelli insisted on building because there's so much that's going on in that set. But the scenes that I find interesting are the double-decker bus scenes and the sort of up the skyscraper scenes, and even when they go to her apartment, which is near the museum, which is near the park. By the way, that's a pretty fancy address for a secretary. I'm just saying.
Also, I mean, there's that incredible scene where they're walking through the park, and the park is a set. I'm pretty sure I've seen it in like Ball of Fire or some Astaire and Rogers movie. So they walk out of the park, and there is a lamppost to hide the seam between the park set and the rear projection screen showing the street scene. And it is just beautifully done and absolutely seamless. You don't even register it. I had to rewind and watch that again to see where the seam was. Vicente Minnelli, man, that dude knows how to make movies. Not necessarily how to...
He's got style.
Yeah, not necessarily how to light movies, because there are scenes in here, including their big kissing scene, that are lit like a straight-up horror movie. But, like, the tracking shot in the subway, where they go out of the subway car, down the platform, through the crowd, and into the next one, and then the camera follows him back as he's running down the platform as the train has gotten her and left him behind. That's astonishing. That is technical virtuosity. I don't expect that level of aplomb in like your basic MGM, here's two people you like, watch them for 90 minutes, America movie.
Well, probably some of that virtuosity comes from his background, not only as a musical film director, but he was a theater director before, which sounds counterintuitive because you think, wait, we're making movies on a big scale. But you are thinking in terms of stylistic elements as opposed to just, you know, making a set where two people are going to get together. I also like the scenes in Penn Station and the other crowd scenes. I like the way he has the extras swirl around. There's a sort of a definite density of the crowd and a definite feeling that he creates. And it feels like there are even different feelings of crowds in different scenes. Like in the first scene where Robert Walker's in Penn Station, there is definitely this sort of swirl and storm in which he's kind of getting lost and buffeted around. And then later on, there are other scenes where they're flowing more with the crowd. And then you notice, because those crowd scenes have happened and they're so interesting, you notice when they're alone and all of a sudden they're by themselves in the park. And I know it's at night, but it's like, wow, it sure is quiet. It sure is lonely in that park, which I guess is appropriate. But I like the way he handles those big crowds. I was sort of ambivalent about the over-the-head scenes. I feel like there are a few too many that are shot from above, but there's the ones, especially the early Penn Station scene, I really enjoy it because it sort of contributes to the mood that he's trying to create.
Look, he'd gotten that crane already. What, is he not going to use it?
It's expensive. I just realized there's a parallel between this movie and Meet Me in St. Louis. So Meet Me in St. Louis, you know, we're on the trolley, jolly, jolly, and Joe Smith is running down the street to jump onto the trolley and then go up and sit with Judy Garland. And then in this movie, Judy's on the bus and he gets off the bus, or he's trying to catch up with the bus and say, will you go out with me? And she says, okay, fine. And he says, where? And she says, under the clock at the Astor at 7. So we've gotten two motorized vehicles, two foes running after Judy Garland in two movies in a row. It's a little
That's
bit like
a Vincente Minnelli move.
So Gosford Park. So there's a scene in Gosford Park where the maid, who's played by, I think, Kelly MacDonald, is looking up through the window at Gosford Park. And then Julian Fellowes repeats that in Downton Abbey, where one of the maids is looking out the window at Downton Abbey. So I guess directors, if they find a little hook that they like, they tend to throw it in a couple more movies.
Well, speaking as a writer, I know that I have tics, and every once in a while, I don't always know what they are, but every once in a while when I read something that I've written in the past, I'll be like, oh, that's a thing I do, and then I try not to do it for the next few times I've written something.
Sure, yeah.
Well, let's talk about Judy Garland a little bit. So she, at this point, is not married to Vincente Minnelli yet. She had made Meet Me in St. Louis with him and wanted him to do The Clock. She wants a dramatic role, and she wants him to be the director of The Clock. Good choices. I think also, because she had done so many musicals, even she's something like 23 at this point, I believe, 23, 24. And because she'd done so many musicals where she's kind of playing younger than she is, even though she doesn't look at all the Mickey Rooney musicals where, you know, they're 18 or 19 or whatever, it seems like, golly gosh, for several years. This is not only a dramatic reveal for her, but it's really her first picture as a woman. And I think she does a great job with it. I'm glad she got the opportunity to, and she was smart to pick her director, because I suspect that she wouldn't have gotten nearly the opportunity to show her range or experiment and figure out what her range was if she hadn't had a director that was very sympathetic to her.
She's really luminous. That was the word I thought of, the way that the camera catches her, and she just seems so young and full of life.
She's young, but she's mature. I mean, that's the thing. I feel like her adolescence was extended for a long period of time because of the kinds of musicals that they put her in. And she, I think, was aware of that. And so she's luminous. Later, when she gets out of her sort of suit skirt thing and she gets into her date dress, you see more of her figure. She looks good. Judy Garland famously had issues with her weight over time. But I think she's photographed beautifully. I think the dress is chosen well for her because she has to be in that dress for a really long time. I remember seeing when she puts that dress on, I remember thinking, I know they're going to be out all night. She's going to be wearing that dress for a long, long part of the movie. And I think it works. And she's photographed very well, even in those really dark scenes. I mean, yes, there are some scenes that I think are a little too dark. And I think the park scenes, because to me, it's so obviously a backdrop, that and the combination of that and the lighting is a little weird. And probably I'm being influenced by what I know is Nathan's perspective. I'm like, yeah, I kind of see what you're talking about there. Hadn't really thought about it before. But I think she does a lot with this part, which on paper, I don't know if there's that much to it, because it's just sort of young lovers having adventures, basically. There's not a lot of depth to the character up until the point where they kind of go, oh, that wedding we just had wasn't all we'd want it to be. You know, let's say our vows in a way that's more emotional to us. But up until then, they're just kind of having adventures together.
Oh, I like toward the end where they're having breakfast after their first night together.
That's a great wedding. Scene.
Yeah, and then when with the coffee, she is looking at him and trying to figure out what, you know, does he want two sugars? Does he want cream? And just learning that, and there's kind of this real tenderness and sense of discovery about that scene that she just does so well. You can finally see that she's in love with him instead of being rushed along in the moment.
Well, that scene I think echoes the breakfast scene with the milkman and his lady, because she's pouring coffee for everyone at the breakfast table, and I think she was, there's some play there where she's figuring out, you know, what do you want in your coffee, and he shows her whatever, and then she's bringing to mind what she saw that morning or the morning before when she poured a cup of coffee for him.
Yeah, I think there's supposed to be an echo of what married life could be, because there's clearly a lot of affection between the milkman and his wife. It's obviously older people and considerably older than them, and there's not a direct line between them, but there is some sort of, oh, well, this is what a relationship, especially after you've known each other for a really long time, what that could be like.
That is a lovely scene, just the unspoken communication between them. It's the one time in the movie where they feel like they have any chemistry whatsoever. And then they immediately go back to not having chemistry. I felt like Garland did pretty well here. She certainly comes across better than Robert Walker. There are definitely some scenes in which she has a warmth and a humanity and a vulnerability that is lovely. And then there are some scenes where she's just very clearly Judy Garlanding, just pretty hard. You know, I don't blame her. This was a stretch for her. She was moving into new territory, and she's clearly trying her best and has some really good moments. And obviously, like, I could not play the part as well as Judy Garland did. I would definitely not fit into the dresses as well.
It's good to know that you're realistic about that. I actually like the scene where they reconsider their vows in the church pew. The part I don't like about it is that I know that it's intended to make a fairly heavy-handed spiritual point the way MGM movies are wont to do, but I think the actors handled it really well. That's, again, a pretty dark scene, and it's just in their faces, and she's reading the vows, and I think it's a nice scene because the rushing of all the steps that they go through to get married, as we talked about before, probably goes on a little bit too long. Okay, we get it. A lot of people want to get married. There are a lot of steps. It's very dehumanizing. And although I don't necessarily like the execution of that, I like the way they find to resolve it, because they could have just had them crying on each other's shoulder or, you know, leaving in awkward anger with one another, not really addressing what's wrong with them, but instead they sort of found a way to bring them a little bit of peace. And except for the heavy-handed spiritualism, I enjoyed it.
I wanted to just get back to the park for 1 second, because you know how we were talking about how those scenes are dark, and then we have this unidentified drunken guy wandering through. If you look another decade later at the bandwagon, one of my absolute favorite scenes is Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse in Central Park. And they're walking, you know, they go for a walk. They've had sort of they're trying to heal their relationship. She doesn't have on clothes to go to a nightclub. She just has on a white shirt dress. And so they go for a walk through the park, and they walk through the little dance floor. And then they do dancing in the dark and leap over the park benches and stuff. And that's a very glamorous way to show Central Park. This is kind of what Central Park can be like in those dark corners. This is much more realistic than, you know, Fred and Sid leaping around and then landing dramatically in a horse-drawn carriage. And I guess maybe Stanley Donen. Did Stanley Donen direct The Bandwagon, or is that Vincent Minnelli again?
It could be Donen.
Yeah,
I'm almost sure it's not Minnelli.
So there's like, let's see how we've used Central Park in the past, and let's make it 50 times more glamorous than we did, you know, 10 years before, 8 years before.
So
and I love The Bandwagon.
Over at The New Yorker, Richard Brody, he's really hot and bothered by the Central Park scene. He actually says, and I have a quote here, it's a sequence quote that I consider one of the greatest ever filmed.
Really?
And yeah, he thinks it's very erotic, and that it says, quote, Minnelli crafts an extended and complex series of images of furious stillness and graceful, nearly balletic maneuvering until the lovers converge and kiss under the glow of streetlights in a match series of some of the most ecstatic close-ups I've ever seen, unquote. And
that's a little much.
That's, wow. Yeah, he's.
I mean, Richard, I remember reading that article and liking it, but when he gets to eroticism, I'm like out. I don't know. It's pretty. Movie's pretty. And the bandwagon is Vincent Minnelli, so I was wrong about that. And I'm a little surprised.
So maybe that was his do-over.
Maybe.
You know, I wish I could.
But that is a beautiful scene.
Yeah, I wish I could have shown Judy, you know, that glamorously. But this was fitting for the time.
With the Central Park scene, I got pulled in when they have a moment and they listen to the cityscape. Yeah. Just for a few seconds, you hear the horns and trains and so on. And it was, and I thought this was really unusual to have a moment in a movie where nobody is talking and you're just in the moment. And I thought how much more effective it would have been during the kissing if they had let that kind of soundscape kind of fade away as they're kissing, instead of going into this huge choral arrangements that I feel like I'm in the Let It Be Beatles session where they're throwing all this lush chorus in the background. And really that whole background music really pulled me away from whatever Richard Brody is getting turned on by.
Yeah, that was a creepy sequence. And I kept thinking, if not for this music telling me this is a love scene, this could be a horror movie. I'm just amazed, though. Can we talk about like the best parts of this movie? Because this movie is a story of the complex clockwork life of a city and the people who make it run that keeps getting trampled over by a pretty boring romance. I love James Gleason, the milkman, and his wife, Lucille Gleason. And holy cow, Keenan wins one scene cameo as the funniest and most authentic drunk guy I've seen in classic Hollywood film. That scene blew me away. I didn't know it was Keenan Wynn. I'd heard Keenan Wynn on Suspense, but I don't think I'd seen him in a lot of movies because I noped out of Kiss Me, Kate before he shows up. But wow, what a funny, funny scene. What a great, realistic, believable performance. We have all seen that guy in a bar somewhere.
Sure.
And it's...
So
yeah.
Here's what's funny about that. So that's not the only time he played a small drunk part, and the fact that he played one scene in a movie like that is just, that's the studio system, y'all. You can call Keenan Wynn up and say, come over for a day. But there's a movie from a year before called Without Love, which unsurprisingly stars Spencer Tracy and Katharine mm-hmm. Hepburn, so I know of where I speak. And Keenan Wynn plays in the beginning a drunk character who is making Spencer Tracy's life difficult and then solving a problem for him. And he's much less effective. He's more of a clown and more of a staggering drunk. But in this scene, yeah, he's great. And I agree. He's very realistic. He's annoying, but that's the part he's playing. And the fact that he just comes in and does that one scene and that he doesn't have to come back and do anything else, I think really works for that part. And James Gleason, I'm not really a fan of his. He's in a lot of movies. He's this sort of character actor that you see in an awful lot of movies, and he can be charming, and he often is. But I often don't find him appealing. But in this movie, he's just so adorable. And I think part of the reason is because he gets to play a little more than one note. He comes in as a certain kind of character. He's this guy who's driving the milk truck, and he's sweet, and he wants his song request on. And then he gets slugged, and so he's not able to be who he was before, and they have to kind of help him and guide him, and they form this little relationship. And that's really great. So you get his character developing and being a little vulnerable, but also still being engaged in the scene. And then he goes home, he takes them home, and we meet his wife, and we just get this instant sense of their chemistry together. And it's just like, oh my God, this is so great.
I really like the milk delivery. Oh, sorry. I just want to say, I really like the whole milk delivery piece of the movie. because we get to see them doing something. And also she's running around with milk bottles and heels and a dinner dress. And then they're delivering milk to different types of people in New York City. It isn't that they're just dropping it off with doormen in a fancy apartment buildings. They're actually going to neighborhoods and dropping off milk. And I kind of like that as far as the whole New York playing a character in the movie. We get a little bit of a sense that New York isn't just tall buildings or Central Park. It's actually the people that live in New York.
I kept worrying that he's not looking at the road as he's driving the milk truck. He kept looking at them. And I actually, somebody with too much time on their hands went online and said he spends 24 seconds not looking at the road during that scene. I was just thinking as you were talking about delivering the milk to different kinds of people, this movie does present a diverse New York, not in terms of the main characters, but you see just in the background, you see a lot of African-American people at various times. And in the line for to get married there, there's an Asian-American couple and people of different types. So it's not just, I think they must have done that, you know, on purpose to show New York isn't just a whole bunch of white people.
Vincent Minnelli's family came from Sicily, and he grew up in Chicago. And Chicago is an extremely diverse city. And the Sicilians in Chicago have their own neighborhood. It's not Little Italy. It's Little Sicily. And so just by osmosis, he would have grown up among a diverse group of people in Chicago. So, and then moved to New York to do theater. And of course the theater is diverse. And I think that was just a little nod, you know, because in the South, they had to cut all the scenes with performers. A lot of Lena Horne stuff never got shown in Southern movie theaters. And I think he's kind of sneaking that in there a little bit, just as his own little homage to the diversity of the city.
I think that's probably true. I also think the budget gave him the chance to just have as many extras as he did, because there are plenty of movies like this where the crowd scene in Penn Station might have had a large number of extras, but you wouldn't have had that many extras in other scenes. And if you think about it, the number of characters with speaking lines is really not that many. I mean, there are a few later on when we get to sort of the jumble of the marriage license bit, there are more sort of bit parts, but mostly it's the two of them. It's the milkman. It's her roommate for one scene. I mean, famously, Bill only gets to say one word. Justice for Bill.
It's the best. I love Bill. That scene is so great. They stretch out the comedic tension so far. It's a great way to play two different emotions at the same time. You've got the serious drama of, you know, don't be with this soldier boy. He's just going to dump you. You can do better, with the comic tension of Bill never getting to say anything. And he's always just about to say something. And then they pay it off. You have forgotten that Bill is there when the payoff comes. It is beautifully constructed, and I wish the whole movie had been that well written. I feel like they brought in an uncredited scriptwriter to punch up certain scenes that didn't have anything to do with the romance, and that guy was like, well, I'm going to outshine you, regular scriptwriter, and they did.
Well, apparently Fred Zinnemann had been involved directing it before Vincent Minnelli got his hands on it, and then Minnelli basically threw out everything Zinnemann did. That's the quote from what I read, threw out everything Zinnemann did. I don't know if that's true. I don't know Zinnemann to be a particularly notable comedy director in any way. I don't think the styles are incompatible. It certainly could have all been Minnelli, but it is kind of interesting. And I don't discredit the writing of the rest of it as much as you do, Nathan. But at the same time, I can certainly appreciate the comedic value of that scene, of the milkman scene. The whole milk sequence is so good. And in fact, it's funny because, like I said, it's been so long since I've seen this. The two things I remember vividly are the Penn Station scene and the whole milkman sequence, because it's just such a nice thing. I mean, they're you know, it's a tropey thing, right? You have a couple that's wandering their way through a city and falling in love as they do. And there are all sorts of things you could have them do, including going to Central Park, because that's what everybody does. But delivering milk, what a great idea.
Yeah, I actually remember having a milkman as a kid. Oh. That would have been into the 70s. Do any of you guys remember that?
We didn't.
Or am I the oldest one?
There was a milkman, Twin Pines Farms, dairy, but my parents were too thrifty to get milk delivered. So I looked longingly as that little yellow and green truck with chocolate milk went down Grant Street. Ooh. But no, we were not about to spend our money on milk deliveries.
We had a milkman in England in the 1980s.
Oh, wow.
Still milkmen. No, there are still places in Michigan, sure. Calder Dairy, I think, delivers. Yeah, you can still get milk delivered.
Oh.
Yeah. It's not like as normal as it once was, but... Yeah, they'll bring you milk, sure.
I think we had milk delivery when I was a very tiny kid. The two things I remember about it, they came in glass bottles. Mm-hmm. But I think I only ever saw the milk truck once because they literally delivered at like 5 a.m. And so as a kid whose mom was watching what I was doing, I was never up to see the milkman. So I always wondered when I started watching movies where they would make jokes about the lady of the house and the milkman. I was like, how did they ever connect? Because their hours are different. But in any case,
I still get bottled water here in San Diego. And delivered, and it's from a company called Pure Flow, and their motto is the best swallow in town. So I just can't give them up just because.
Well, all right then. That is how they'll keep in business.
Did we talk about the escalator? I found that while researching this. So they, as we talked about, they did they filmed the film on a lot in Hollywood, and. They couldn't do her tripping and losing her heel on stairs, apparently. They couldn't figure out how to make that work. So they had to build an escalator. But there were some problems with the supply chain during the war. And it turns out it's a ramp. So if you look closely, apparently you never actually see the stairs of the escalator because there are no stairs and the railings are higher than normal. And it just seemed to me it's a really kind of a fun, creative way to deal with that kind of logistics problem instead of just rewriting the scene or that kind of thing that they just made a ramp for people to ride up.
I do like the idea that he'd never seen an escalator before. I guess northern Minnesota or wherever although honestly we had an escalator in our department store in Ann Arbor, so it must have been a pretty small little town on the prairie kind
of place. Pretty sure this guy has never seen a store before. I'm amazed this guy has seen a woman.
He's got hay in his hair still, the guy does. I mean, and as I say, like if it had been Robert Walker from 2 years before, it would have been full on Gomer Pyle because he was just so much into that. And he's I think he's from Missouri or somewhere. But then he and Jennifer Jones got together. She's from Oklahoma or somewhere. Mm-hmm. But the characters he was playing, I think it was built up that he was who he was. But in any case,
that's funny that our perceptions of actors that. You know, even if we've seen them in one movie, can really color how we look at them. Because you're mentioning that he used to play these kind of podunk characters, but I kept thinking he's going to be on the subway and then turn to Frelly Granger and say crisscross.
Right.
Shoves Judy Garland in front of a train, walks away whistling.
But see, that's the trouble. Like when I think that is something I think about when I talk about old movies with people that have seen different ones than I have or in different order than I have, because you're like, oh, yeah, that's the guy from Strangers on a Train. And there we go. And it's like, well, yeah, but that was like 7 years before he made Strangers on a Train and he wasn't working with Hitchcock.
Now, I will say, as much as I have bagged on this film, I have to give the love story some credit. There's a time in your life, usually around adolescence, where, you know, maybe you're in town to visit somebody and you really like them and you only have so much time to spend with them. And every moment feels both fleeting and precious and also like trapped in amber. Mm-hmm. And that this movie does capture that a little bit enough to make me go, yeah, OK, movie, I see what you're doing there. I wish it had been better in a lot of ways. I love the supporting cast and wish the central actress had been better. But it really does capture that fleeting, ephemeral sense of just falling for someone and wanting to spend every possible moment you can with them because you're like, sooner or later, this bubble's going to burst. I just want to stay in this bubble as long as I can.
And then you're sitting there, you're wondering, where'd that chorus come from? It's right here.
Why is there a full orchestra? I would love it if they'd panned over and been like, you know, Saturday evening orchestra in the park.
Along came Bill. Thank goodness, because at that point we could use a little comedy.
But, I would love it if Bill just kept popping up throughout the movie randomly. Hi.
Oh, that would be funny. Bill. It's like cameos. Like he's a clerk in the court when they're going to get their license or something.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, if you didn't, I mean, we know all the details that the movie was, you know, seems like 43, came out 45, Europe's over. But if you didn't know all that and you were watching this movie, you know, 60, 70 years after it was made, you could see this as a capsule weekend of World War II. And I think in that aspect, it definitely fulfills its purpose. You know, if you made a time capsule of World War II movies, you would definitely want a movie where a boy and girl met and had a fast romance. Well, think about The Best Years of Our Lives. Dana Andrews and is it Gloria Graham? And they met and married
Virginia Mayo.
Sorry, Virginia Mayo. And they met and married hastily, and he went off to war, and then she was stuck at home. Well, this is, I mean, obviously Judy Garland. Garland is not Virginia Mayo in any shape or form, but she's in exactly the same situation.
Well, and what's great about The Best Years of Our Lives, which we talked about, is the Virginia Mayo, you get to see the aftermath of that because there are plenty of movies where you get to see they're going off to war and either the guy doesn't come back or he's going to come back and you don't see it. And that movie is where they've come back and you're sort of imagining that in a movie that was filmed 3 years earlier, they pledged their undying love for each other. And now they're like, what do I do now?
Well, at least Robert Walker isn't creeping out the children anymore.
I was wondering when somebody was going to bring
just
up why in the world did they feel compelled to have Robert Walker freak children out twice in 5 minutes?
And then at the end of the film, magically, he does not.
Right. He's learned his lesson.
I love that tough little kid. That's a New York kid right there.
He is a good kid. I enjoy him, too.
Yeah. Get away from me, you random creep in the zoo. Kicks his shin, grabs his boat, runs. Good on you, kid. Way to internalize those stranger danger messages.
Robert Walker's like, wait, I'm not sure I'm prepared for the army. This little kid had my number, and he's like eight.
Well, you know, as long as the German army isn't fielding 8-year-olds against Robert Walker, he'll be fine.
That's what Judy Garland is going to count on for the next 6 months while he's away at war. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining me for this discussion of The Clock. I always enjoy when I can make people watch a random movie that I've decided to watch. And frankly, I did it because I read that Richard Brody article. And having not seen that article, the movie in quite some time, I was like, I don't remember it exactly like that, but it makes it sound pretty. So I'm going to watch it. And I am glad I did, even flaws notwithstanding. So thank you to you, Nathan Alderman, Randy Dottinga, and Mickey Maynard for joining me. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. You can follow us at Lion Tower Shield. God, sorry. I'm going to start over again because
actually,
I tried to do that without breathing.
I actually have one final thought. Can I
go
say
ahead.
One final
Final thought? Thoughts, okay. Please.
My only final thought is right at the end of the movie. Where's the hotel? How did they get a suite? Where did she get that negligee from? Where did the...
I wondered that too.
Where's the rope? Did she go home and get the negligee? I mean, did he get a... Is there a gift shop in the lobby that he got a nice bathrobe from? I mean,
he was carrying a bag. He could have a robe, but I did wonder about her negligee.
Right, it's a really nice negligee. And I thought that was the prettiest that she looked in the movie, was at the, you know, they've now consummated things and they're very happy about it and enjoying their breakfast. And but I'm like, okay, where did she get the negligee?
Fair question. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining me for a discussion of The Clock, a movie that I convinced you all to watch because I read an article in The New Yorker and thought, oh, that movie sounds pretty. I don't remember it as well as I thought I did, but I enjoyed it nonetheless. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you can find us at theincomparable.com/LTS. You can follow us on Twitter, as long as Twitter lasts, at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a very different film the Manchurian Candidate. Bye, everybody.